Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter Jr., Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter Jr.
The Japanese government, citizens, and groups are debating what to do with radioactive water from the disabled nuclear power center near Fukushima. An earthquake and tsunami on March 11, 2011, caused severe damage to three of the six nuclear reactors at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Since then, Japanese officials have been struggling to contain and clean up the damage. The Associated Press recently observed the decontamination process taking place there. Officials are trying to decide what to do with 1.2 million tons of radioactive water being stored at Fukushima. The nuclear center is operated by the Tokyo Electric Power Company, or TEPCO. The company says it needs to free up space as work on the damaged reactors reaches an important point. Many people expect TEPCO to slowly release the water into the ocean near the nuclear centers. The government has already approved the plan. However, it is not clear when the company will carry out the plan. Local people oppose it because releasing the water into the nearby sea could hurt fisheries. Sales of fish caught off the coast near Fukushima are 50% of what they were before the nuclear disaster. Fish caught in the area have been approved for sale after radioactivity testing by health officials. TEPCO Chief Decommissioning Officer Akiro Ono said the water must be removed. He says crews need the space currently occupied by the water tanks. In their place, workers will set up structures to hold melted reactor wreckage. Workers are planning to remove wreckage of the melted reactor by December 2021. Special equipment is taking apart Unit 2. Radioactive waste is being removed from Unit 3. People wear protective clothing and head coverings to work in all but the most radioactive areas around the nuclear center. But underground, conditions remain dangerous and radioactive water is leaking from the melted reactors and mixing with groundwater. This water is being pumped into containers to keep it from flowing into the sea. The contaminated water from underground is processed and filtered to remove dangerous radioactive elements. Tritium is the only radioactive material that remains. Japan's industry ministry and nuclear officials say tritium is not harmful in small amounts. However, Although officials try to ease public fear, there are worries that fish might be affected if the water is released into the sea. Katsumi Shozugawa is a radiology expert at the University of Tokyo. He has been studying the underground water around the nuclear center. He said long-term results of low-level exposure to radioactivity in the food chain has not been fully studied. At this point, it is difficult to predict risk, he said. Once the water is released into the environment, it will be very difficult to follow up and monitor its movement. After years of discussions, a government group released a report earlier this year. It proposed two possible ways to dispose of the treated water. One method would mix treated water with fresh water and release it into the ocean. A second method would permit the water to dry up over time. The report also urged the government to do more to fight the reputational damage done to Fukushima's fishing and farming products. TEPCO and government officials have said they will treat the water a second time to meet legal requirements before any release. Masumi Kawata lives in Okuma, a town close to the nuclear center. She said some of her neighbors are offering their land as a place to put more water storage tanks. We should not dump the water until we have proof about its safety, she said. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
Saudi Arabia has directed the state oil company, Aramco, to increase its total possible oil production, or capacity. It announced the move at the Saudi Tadawul Stock Exchange Wednesday. A short time later, Abu Dhabi's oil and gas company, ADNOC, said it was increasing production by 25% to 4 million barrels per day. Saudi Arabia is working to flood the market after another oil producer, Russia, refused to agree to oil production cuts. Worldwide, demand for oil is decreasing as the spread of the new coronavirus has interfered with travel, transport, and other industries. Saudi Arabia said earlier this week it would increase its oil production to 12.3 million barrels a day starting in April. That is 300,000 barrels per day more than Aramco's current production. Now, the company says it will produce up to 13 million barrels per day. Saudi Arabia has been producing around 9.8 million barrels per day. That amount was in line with an agreement among a number of oil-producing nations, including Russia. The cuts were an attempt to stop the oversupply in the market that had pushed prices down. However, a few days ago, the kingdom's policy changed completely when Russia refused to go along with deeper cuts. Saudi Arabia is a member of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, or OPEC. It is expected that other members of that group will also increase production. The price of unprocessed or crude oil went down 25% on Monday. It was the sharpest decrease since the 1991 Gulf War. By yesterday, the price had increased a small amount. By the end of trading, oil was at $36 a barrel. I'm Susan Shand.
A Chinese company says it has created a new facial recognition system that can identify people even if they are wearing masks. Developers began working on the new system in January when cases of the new coronavirus began rising in China. The fast spread of the virus, which can be deadly, has led most Chinese citizens to wear face masks in public to help reduce infections. China is recognized as a world leader in the development of artificial intelligence and facial recognition systems. Engineers at the Beijing-based Hanwang Technology Limited say their system is the first to be created to effectively identify people wearing face masks. The company told the Reuters news agency that a team of 20 people built the system in about a month. The system is based on existing technologies developed over the past 10 years. The process involved adding a collection of about 6 million unmasked faces and a much smaller collection of masked faces, the company said. Hanwang is now selling two main kinds of products that use the new technology. One performs single-channel recognition, which is designed to be used at the entrances to buildings. The other product is a multi-channel recognition system that uses groups of surveillance cameras. Hanwang's vice president, Huang Lei, told Reuters that the multi-channel system can identify individuals in a crowd of up to 30 people within a second. When wearing a mask, the recognition rate can reach about 95%, which can ensure that most people can be identified, Huang said. He added that the system's success rate for people not wearing a mask is about 99.5%. The company says one of the largest users of the new system is China's Ministry of Public Security, which operates the country's police agencies. The Chinese government widely uses cameras and facial recognition technology for identification purposes and to record people's movements. Huang said officials can use Hanwang's technology to compare images with ministry records on individuals in order to identify and track people as they move about. The system can identify crime suspects, terrorists, or make reports or warnings, he added. However, the new system struggles to identify people wearing both a mask and sunglasses. In this situation, all of the key facial information is lost. In such cases, recognition is tough, Huang said. It was not immediately clear how Chinese citizens were reacting to the new technology. The Chinese government has already been using other surveillance tools in the fight against the new coronavirus. While some citizens have expressed opposition to such tools, many others seem to have accepted the methods as a way to deal with the current health emergency. So far, Huang says most interest in the new system has come from within China. But he sees the interest likely expanding if the virus continues to spread and the use of face masks increases. I'm Brian Lin.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. In recent programs, we talked about how the rise of fascist leaders in Europe threatened American neutrality in the 1930s. Adolf Hitler and the Nazi Party in Germany created the most obvious threat. But there was also Benito Mussolini in Italy and Francisco Franco in Spain. These leaders challenged both the idea of democracy and the security of some of America's closest allies. Hitler's invasion of Poland and the spread of war in Europe in 1939 made Americans wonder if they could remain neutral much longer. The United States would finally go to war against Hitler and the other Axis nations. But its first battle would not be in Europe at all. Instead, the United States would enter World War II following a surprise attack by Japan on the large American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. Relations between the United States and Japan had grown steadily worse throughout the 1930s. Both nations were important industrial powers, but they had very different ideas about the economic and political future of East Asia, especially China. Until the late 1800s, Japan had been a nation with ancient political traditions and little contact with the Western world. Visits by Commodore Matthew Perry and American warships helped open Japan to trade with the United States and other nations in the 1850s. And in the years that followed, Japan took major steps toward becoming a modern industrial nation. By the 1920s and 30s, Japan was a strong country, but it lacked oil, rubber, and other natural resources of its own. For this reason, Japanese political leaders looked with envy at the Dutch, French, and British colonies across Southeast Asia and the Pacific. And Japanese business leaders saw huge markets for their products in nearby countries like Korea and China. Japan's desire to use East Asia to gain natural resources and sell manufactured products was in direct conflict with American plans for Asia. This was especially true concerning China. Washington created an open-door policy toward China. It wanted to keep China's natural resources and markets free from control by Japan or any other nation. For this reason, Americans were very concerned when Japanese forces invaded the Manchuria area of China in 1931. And and they watched with great interest the efforts of Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek to oppose the Japanese invaders. The United States was also very concerned about protecting its imports of oil, tin, and rubber from Southeast Asia. This area of the world was a major supplier of these resources in the 1930s. The Middle East had not yet become a leading producer of oil. In these ways, the United States and Japan were competing for the same resources and Asian markets. However, there also was a good deal of trade between the two nations. In fact, Japan depended on the United States for most of its metal, copper, and oil. This trade with Tokyo became a major concern for President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Congress in 1937. In the summer of that year, more Japanese troops moved into China. They quickly captured much of the Chinese coast. Much of the metal, oil, and other materials that Japan used for its war effort in China came from the United States. Americans did not like selling Japan materials to use against China, but the trade was legal because of a 1911 agreement between Tokyo and Washington. However, the American government told Japan in 1939 that it would end the earlier agreement. It would no longer sell Japan materials that could be used for war. Washington's decision made the Japanese government think again about its expansionist plans, and the announcement a month later of a non-aggression treaty between Germany and the Soviet Union gave Tokyo even more cause for concern. The Soviet Union could be a major opponent of Japanese expansion in East Asia, and it appeared free from the threat of war in Europe. These two events helped moderates in the Japanese government to gain more influence over foreign policy. A moderate government took power in January 1940. However, this period of moderation in Tokyo did not last long. In the spring of 1940, Germany launched its Blitzkrieg, or lightning invasion of Europe. The Nazis captured Denmark, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, and finally France. Extremists in the Japanese government saw the German victory as their chance to launch their own attack on European colonies in Asia. They quickly began negotiations with Hitler to form a new alliance, and within months, militant leaders overthrew the moderate government in Tokyo. The new Japanese government was headed by a moderate, Prince Konoye, but the Minister of War was an expansionist, General Tojo. Tokyo wasted no time in taking action. It forced France to give Japan permission to occupy northern Indochina. And Tokyo also demanded that Britain close the Burma Road to the Chinese city then known as Chungking. The Burma Road was a major route by which the United States was supplying China with munitions as part of the Lend-Lease Act. These events caused relations between Tokyo and Washington to become even worse. In the second half of 1940, President Roosevelt banned the export of metal and oil products to Japan. His administration also lent money to China. America began to supply Chiang Kai-shek's government with a fleet of P-40 fighter airplanes with volunteer pilots led by Army aviator Claire Chennault to train Chinese pilots. The squadron became known as the Flying Tigers. American representatives quietly began to meet with British and Dutch officials to discuss joint defense plans for possible Japanese attacks in the Western Pacific. Washington and Tokyo held long negotiations in 1941. The American officials hoped the negotiations might delay Japan from launching an attack to the south. They also thought that a delay might give more moderate leaders in Japan a chance to gain more influence. And, for a time, the American plan worked. Japan did not make new acts of aggression. Again, events in Europe caused this situation to change. Nazi Germany attacked the Soviet Union in the middle of 1941. This prevented Moscow from doing any fighting on its eastern borders, so Japanese troops were free to invade southern Indochina. President Roosevelt reacted to Japan's invasion of Indochina by taking three major steps. First, he took control of all Japanese money in the United States. Second, he brought the armed forces of the Philippines under American command. And third, he closed the Panama Canal to Japanese shipping. Once again, a conflict developed between moderates and extremists in the Japanese government. More moderate leaders, such as Prime Minister Konoye, urged one more effort to reach an agreement with the United States. But the Japanese Army and Navy believed that the time had come to go to war to end American and European power in East Asia forever. Negotiations between Japan and the United States continued through the final months of 1941, but the two nations were on the edge of war. They were as close to hostilities as Washington was with the Nazi government in Berlin. American military officials captured secret messages from Japan during this time. They learned that Tokyo was planning an attack of some kind unless the United States suddenly changed its policies. However, the American officials could not discover exactly where or how the attack would be made. Almost everyone in Washington expected that the Japanese would attack south of Japan. They were wrong. The military leaders in Tokyo were planning a surprise attack on America's main Pacific military base at Pearl Harbor.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.